This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Spring is my favorite time to start a new workout routine. With the weather warming up, it feels easier to get into the rhythm of things. Whether you have 20 minutes or an hour for a Pilates class or outdoor guided walk, Peloton has everything you need to help you get going. Get a head start on summer with Peloton at onepeloton.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
BBC Sounds, music, radio, podcasts.
Hello and welcome to the Woman's Hour podcast for Christmas Eve, the 24th of December, 2019. I'm Jenny Murray. Good morning. Tomorrow, more than a million people will go to work on Christmas Day, and a significant number of them will be nurses. What's it like to spend the day in hospital? 2019 has been an eventful year in Northern Ireland's second city, Londonderry. We talked to four women about life in their city. They're contemporaries of the fictional Derry girls who were teenagers in the 90s. And super troopers. We've a tour around the ABBA exhibition with their history, their costumes, and of course, a tune or two. Now, if you're a fan of television drama, and I certainly am, you can't have missed Joanna Scanlon. She was the inept civil servant in The Thick of It, the ward sister in Getting On, the detective inspector in No Offence, the dog trainer in Puppy Love, and most recently a grieving mother in The Accident. And now she's to play the mother superior in the dramatisation of the very scary and rather bloody story of Dracula, which comes to BBC One on New Year's Day. Stand by for a short but chilling bit.
Superior, on no account invite that creature in. That is not a temptation with which I was struggling. What is happening? What is this?
We are under attack from the forces of darkness.
Why would the forces of darkness wish to attack a convent?
Perhaps they are sensitive to criticism.
Dolly Wells as Sister Agatha and Joanna as Mother Superior, and no further details, of course, about what's threatening them. We will give nothing away. It's scary, Joanna, but it's funny at times. I mean, that is a great line. Perhaps they're sensitive to criticism. And Dracula is sometimes horrid, but also rather sexy. How would you describe it?
Good morning, Jenny. Yes, it's a cocktail, isn't it? Yes, it has. Well, yeah, Stephen Moffat, Mark Gatiss have pulled it off, I would say, in terms of this is a genuinely scary winter. Stay in by the fire, pull your duvet very high up against your neck and enjoy that sort of proper ride of fear into our greatest, you know, our greatest sort of morbid side. However, the wit that they've done it with is genius, and there are moments of proper laughs, and some of those are almost the kind of laughs that you dare not actually do out loud because it's you're not sure if you should laugh or not. It's very clever.
How familiar were you with the Bram Stoker original?
Not at all. I have never read the Bram Stoker, and I think that's probably when you come from a generation who've been saturated by versions of Dracula, you don't really know who Dracula is. But the nearest I got to it was my beloved uncle took me to see in 1979 the Herzog version, Nosferatu, starring Klaus Kinski. And that was a much different vibe of Dracula than the sort of Hammer versions that I'd known before. And that absolutely fascinated me and stayed with me forever. And so my version was always that Klaus Kinski sort of perfection.
And we're not going to give anything away because they've said to us, please don't give anything away, haven't they? Let's move on then to something else. You've starred in some of the most successful television series, and I wondered how significant was the detective inspector in No Offence. She's very sure of herself, including her size and her sexuality.
Yeah, I mean, Viv Deering is the most wonderful creation. It was a joy to play her. And it's almost like you put a stand-up character in the middle of a police office, because all her dialogue was fast, rapid, witty put-downs and very sharp things. And because, I don't know, when you've got a... As an actor, I find I've got to work physically. Even if it's very sharp dialogue, I've still got to kind of play it through the body. So it ended up being I had to kind of swing my hips and move my shoulders. I couldn't remember my lines unless I did that. You know, it was because it's a fast turnover TV. So it ended up being something that she costumed very, very flagrantly, and she was always going to play that. And she believed she was sexy. She is sexy, and had a history of men that actually had been rather disastrous. And as many women who experience those problems with men, she's still going to assert above and beyond it. She was never, ever going to be a victim.
What impact do you reckon the role had on the way women are seen on screen? It was very, very different.
Do you think so? I mean, that's something I wasn't aware of. I go about my life. I guess I had to go deep into my own experience. And my grandmother was very sexy and very, very pretty. And she came from St. Helens. And so I guess I got to know her probably in her 50s and 60s and 70s. She never gave up for one moment her sexuality. And she was always big and bosomy and strong. And I think the reality of life, we all know people who are many kinds of overweight, if you like. But that doesn't stop them being living full and huge lives. And the fact that that's not depicted on screen has just never got in my way. I just don't buy into it. And I'm trying to look for real examples, both in my own experience and even on the bus.
Now, Getting On, set in a geriatric ward, was written, I think, by you, Vicky Pepperdine, and Joe Brand. How accurate was its portrayal of such a ward? And was it Joe's experience that really gave you the bottom for that?
Joe had had a long time as a psychiatric nurse. And when we were trying to find something that would be a suitable arena for three women to play in, we suggested a ward, a general medical ward. And we started some research, and Vicky and I went into a few different hospitals over the different series. And we'd go in, almost take a snapshot of one place, just observe as carefully and as in as much detail as possible what was going on, take that away, and then turn that into something that was accurate. Funnily enough, a lot of the lines came from things we heard people actually say. Particularly some of Pippa's lines. We also had friends who were doctors, nurses, and, you know, plundered them for everything that they could give us. And the intention was always to be very, very accurate, rather than just find something and then make it funny. Peter Capaldi was a huge part of that. He set it in a way that was naturalistic and was realistic, and he made it look as if he put a sort of dullness, if you like, on the screen. And that reflected something that we feel often walking into a hospital, or at least you used to. I think hospitals try these days to put many more colours around. But when I used to go into hospitals as a child, suddenly it was as if you were upon the whole scene descended a veil of greyness. And so we looked for different ways to express reality of the experience of being in one of those wards. And then, of course, the black humour comes out.
Now, I know you studied history at Queen's College, Cambridge in 1980, among the first women to go there.
Yes, one of 39.
What was it like to be one of very few women?
It was actually awful, I confess. It was really tough. And I had gone from a girls' boarding school in North Wales without a year out, so no gap year or anything, very green. And I had this, but I'd read a lot of feminism, 70s feminism. And so I had huge aspirations about what it was like to be a pioneer as a woman. And I arrived and none of those were made possible. My college had had, the previous year they'd had, at the end of the summer, they'd had something that they called the Stag Night, which was a sort of, well, a stag night of sorts. And it had got into the papers because it'd been picketed by Newnham girls. And so this sense of like us and them, girls and boys, was very strong. And I found it very, very hard. I won't go into the details of very bad behaviour that went on, but it did. And I was not equipped. It took me a long, long, long time, possibly 10 years, to even begin to recover.
Is that why you came to acting fairly late, to professional acting?
I think it's part of it, yes. I was, again, very naive. I'd always wanted to act. I'd done loads and loads through school, and that was always my intention. And I did, obviously, in the end, quite a lot at university. But then when I left, nothing happened. I just got a lot of rejections and couldn't work out how to do it, if you like. And that partly was because I was still suffering depression in those years, which was to do with, I mean, it's probably an exaggeration, but I won't say, it feels to me like I arrived at university and I was running full pelt and I hit a brick wall. And that wall took a lot of dismantling, you know, as I say, about 10 years. And then it was 10 years later, I decided, yeah, I'm going to now do what I think I was put on the earth to do.
For which we are all extremely grateful. Joanna Scanlon, thank you very much for being with us. And I'll just mention the three episodes of Dracula will be broadcast on the 1st, the 2nd and the 3rd of January. And they are scary. Thank you. Now, 2019 has been another eventful year in Northern Ireland's second city, Londonderry. There was the shocking murder of the young journalist Lyra McKee, who was shot by dissident Republicans, and as a border city, it's been at the heart of the Brexit debate. The Northern Ireland Assembly at Stormont is still deadlocked over power sharing. On a lighter note, it has also basked in the success of the second series of the hit Channel 4 comedy series Derry Girls, the raucous misadventures of a group of teenagers growing up in the 90s. So what do real Derry girls from both communities make of the past year in their city? Well, Kathleen Carraher spoke to four Derry women who are contemporaries of television's Derry Girls. They were teenagers in the 90s.
I'm Jean Ann. I'm a Derry girl from around the corner. And I lived in London for 12 years and Dublin for 4 years before that. And I've been back in Derry with my family for a year now.
And I'm Erin. I grew up in Derry as well and moved to England, lived in London and Yorkshire. So just returned last year, just here over a year now, again, with our wee girl and husband back from England now. So,
my name's Niamh. I grew up in Derry. I left for university in Dublin when I was 19, and then I lived in various cities all through my 20s. I was Dublin, then I was London, then I was Belfast, then I went back to Dublin, and I eventually moved back here in 2012.
My name is Rachel, and I'm a Derry girl all my life too, but I moved to Liverpool there for university. I stayed there for about 7 years, and then as soon as I got pregnant with my wee boy, I came back to be close to my mommy.
So did you say that the Derry girls like to be close to their mommy? Was that the case for all of you?
Oh, absolutely. As soon as I got pregnant, it was like, I have to come home. My mommy's one of 13, so we had all the cousins, first cousins, every Christmas parties and every weekend. And now I live two doors away from my sister and her three wains, so we're all on the same street. It's kind of embarrassing now to say, but proper Derry style.
Yeah. And it's not just the family, it's the access to nature. Beaches are on your doorstep. There's amazing schools. Like, I think the schools here are some of the best, you know, across the UK and Ireland, and just a really good quality of life and the sense of humour as well.
I think that, you know, there's just a very strong sense of identity in Derry as well, you know, and it probably comes from the recent past and the times that people have been through, that they've really pulled together. And so you really do feel that kind of sense of community.
Yeah.
And everybody knows everybody. And like, I know that you say that about other places, but like in Derry, it really, really feels like you're connected.
Derry was once known for its shirt factories, and it was in the shirt factories that the women worked, and it was the women who earned the wages because there was no work for men. That's led to a very strong tradition of independent women in Derry. Is that still the case?
That's definitely the case. It's something my mommy tells me all the time. You know, my granny was the one that went out and worked. She went out and she sorted her family out, and the boys were babied and the girls were told to get on and get on with it.
Yeah. And glamorous with it.
Oh my gosh.
I just think of my own granny here and her kind of hard work in the shirt factories over the years and raising not only sometimes her own kids, but, you know, extended family often came and stayed as well. And there was, you know, there was that hard work and there was the grit, but there was also just an amazing sense of humour, an amazing sense of fun.
My granny Maisie, she was ultra glamorous as well. She was a shirt factory woman, raised 7 children, made all her own clothes, and just kept her children out of trouble during the troubles as well. There was that sense of real protectiveness. They were like the original tiger mothers, maybe.
You've talked a lot there about the community spirit and how people get on and everybody knows everybody else, but it is a city that has an image of division. Mm-hmm. People don't even agree on the name. Derry, Londonderry.
I think we've got a sense of humour behind it now too. I think, yes, when it's official, you have to go Derry, Londonderry. But I think when day-to-day life, people working and people interacting with one another, it never ever comes up, I don't think, unless it's a bit of a jab and a joke.
There's a nice compromise now as well where people call it Legendary. Has kind of been taken on as a kind of legendary food brand for Derry to kind of promote the city's like food offering. Yeah. And Legendary sounds like a good way to keep everybody happy.
Just wanted to ask you then what you think the TV series The Derry Girls has done for Derry.
I mean, it's so refreshing to see our city depicted in such a positive light, obviously under the shadow of a very turbulent time in our history, the 90s. But what I love about it is the fact that these young girls and the wee English fella, they have like a joy in life, and you know, they're only interested in getting up to their take that concert and, you know, going out and having fun. And that's what we were like, you know. We had those teenage problems, you know, there were terrible things going on around us, but you know, we were worried about the weekend and what we were going to wear and, you know, who we were going to meet and things like that.
So in day-to-day life, it was an inconvenience more than anything. And it was, as Derry Girls depicts, it was a source of black humour. Like, I remember we lived quite centrally in Derry. Coming out on our doorstep, there'd often be a soldier pointing his gun out to the street, and my daddy one time came out and just said, "Oh, some people get a garden gnome and we get a British soldier." And the next morning there was a garden gnome on our doorstep. But that just, I think that's really summed up in Derry Girls as well. Yeah, life went on. Yeah. But at the same time, there were those dark times. And, you know, as I said, in adulthood, you realise that that was a normal, very happy childhood in abnormal circumstances.
In the series, Sister Michael plays quite a role, and obviously the religion is quite a backdrop. So where's religion in Derry today? For instance, would you all go to church?
No, unfortunately not. The last time I went to church was with my granny whenever I was about 13. So no, I don't think it plays as much of a big part in Derry. I, thank God, didn't have any nuns in my school. I went to an integrated school. But they were always still scary whenever you seen them from other schools. No, so definitely not anymore.
It's kind of, Derry kind of reflects modern society in Ireland and the UK, you know. For some people, faith is still very, very strong and very much part of their weekly routine. And for others, kind of looking in other directions, you know, for fulfilment and things like that. The one thing I will say about Mass, it was good for the talent spotting now on Sunday morning as well. Like, that used
your
to be
your makeup all
you did your makeup perfect at all, just in case you saw who you might want to see.
There's always a bit of crack about who was there and who wasn't there, definitely.
Would you have friends then from both communities? Is that very common?
Absolutely. Definitely. I mean, there was lots of cross-community work that went on, you know, around the time that I was growing up as a teenager in Derry, and I was always very much encouraged to take those opportunities, which I think was great, you know, just in terms of giving you that more open mind when you went out into the world. You know, I think, you know, the more that we can learn, there is that real embracing of diversity, I think, generally. And I think the more that we can focus on that and kind of teach our children that it's more than just Protestants and Catholics that live in the world as well.
Yeah, this year Derry made headlines for the wrong reasons with the murder of Lara McKee by dissident Republicans. Mm-hmm. What do you make of that?
What I felt so bad about in terms of Lara was that she moved here, mm-hmm. you know, and she had found a person that she loved from Derry, oh, yeah. and, you know, they were going to settle down here, and she really loved it here. And I just feel almost a sense of shame that that happened to her mm-hmm. on the streets of our city. And she was a creative person yeah. who came here, and those are the type of people we want to attract to Derry. And it's overwhelmingly sad that she was murdered here.
Mm-hmm. And the outpouring afterwards of grief and anger just showed that is not what Derry is about. That's not what we want for this city, for our future, for our children. Like, there was such a campaign of not in our name after yeah. that happened, that this does not represent mm-hmm. us. And it was just absolutely awful.
Do you remember what the priest said at her funeral, Father McGill?
Yes, that he told the politicians that they needed to really get their heads together and sort things out and get talking again. I remember that day, the goosebumps of hearing that and thinking, right, this is actually going to be a kind of watershed moment. Things are going to change. Yeah. Like, you know, in a year's time or in 10 years' time, when my child is learning history at school, she'll learn that things improved again from that point. But nothing's happened. Nothing's happened at all.
Improved, unfortunately, yeah. since then.
I kind of feel like the ground is a little bit shaky now because of the lack of government at Stormont and the lack of people representing us, the people that we voted for, can't get their work done. It's definitely kind of destabilised us a little bit yeah. and it kind of feels like the ground is shaking beneath our feet, and it would just be wonderful to see them back in there, because I think that does filter down into society. If we can see it on the TV, our politicians are sharing power and kind of collaborating, then that does filter down, you know, through society.
And I think that people are crying out for a strong voice, mm-hmm. especially, you know, at this crucial time that we're in with Brexit and uncertainty all over, really.
So you've mentioned Brexit there. Do you follow the debate closely?
Yeah, without a doubt. Whatever happens, it will have an impact on where we live. For me, it might be a weekly trip. You know, for other people, they're living and working on two different sides of the border. And it seems a shame that, you know, that should be anything other than seamless, really. Life could become a lot more awkward. I don't think living in this area, we see a border, you know, we very much move between two areas.
This year there's been lots of social change now, and in fact Westminster has been the body that has legislated for both same-sex marriage and abortion, two big, big issues in Northern Ireland. What do you make of those?
Obviously, I'm disappointed it wasn't done here through our own people, but I'm happy. You know, it's done. It's one of the biggest things that was being held over us, and now it's done. Nobody can change it.
These are the kind of social issues that we are concerned with.
Yeah.
Most people in Derry and Northern Ireland are concerned with these social issues. You know, these are the things that affect our loved ones and our friends. It's not just orange and green that we're all worried about all the time. No. It's not just the religious divide, it's these social issues, something like filling in a pothole or fixing a road or, you know, being allowed to marry the person you love. These are the kinds of things that we all care about as human beings, I think, in general, a lot more than sectarianism, certainly.
Yeah. Yet a lot of people here still, particularly with abortion, are opposed to it, aren't they?
It's an interesting one, because you look at the south of Ireland, where you would have assumed was, you know, a very traditional church-led society. They've actually been very progressive, you know, obviously on abortion and gay marriage. And Northern Ireland has maybe some catching up to do, but it is a real sort of flashpoint for some people. They're very passionate anti-abortion. That's maybe as well where you see the influence of religion in the church more than in other areas.
So another big topic this year has been climate change, and obviously we've had Extinction Rebellion and we've had Greta Thunberg.
We're all making small things that we weren't before because of Greta and because of the, you know, everybody's trying their little bit, and it's little, but it's great.
Yeah.
In my family, it's recycling, it's, you know, not buying new, going to secondhand shops, even Meatless Monday, you know, using, you know, vegetable lasagna rather, you know.
I am trying to eat less meat, trying to recycle, although my husband and I regularly fall out about what's supposed to go in the recycling bin, you know, where sometimes we're not too sure and we're looking it up on the internet and trying to figure it out.
To me, the climate change issue feels like something that's right now much bigger than any one of us.
That's where the government has to come in and help with the infrastructure of the trains.
Yeah, if we had like a high-speed train to Belfast or something, you know, and you could, you know, with amazing internet and, you know, you could just zoom up and down really easily. But, you know, I go to Belfast a lot and I do usually drive. It's just more practical. Yeah. It's tough. You know,
so you might as well drive and sing your heart out on the way up.
Listen to Women's Hour.
Talking about singing, next year, 2020, it's a big anniversary. 50 years of Dana singing, all kinds of everything.
I heard a lot about Dana because she was the schoolgirl that came back in my mum's time, having won the Eurovision Song Contest. So yeah, we heard a lot about her growing up. And I think, you know, for a generation of Derry girls, she was a really successful figure, a really positive figure.
My mother was, Anne would have been in school shows with her. She remembers that just the excitement of this 18-year-old coming from a really difficult part of the world and bringing home the Eurovision.
But one of the things that people noticed about Dana was her accent, and her accent was different. The Derry accent gets a lot of comment, doesn't it?
Well, I think as we've seen from Nadine Coyle on I'm a Celebrity, people still struggle to get to grips with it. She does have a broad accent, but why shouldn't she? She's from Derry. She's completely comprehensible to anyone.
What are your favourite Derry phrases and the famous Derry humour?
Wise up, I'd say, is a good one. Anyone that's getting notions about themselves, you just say, wise up.
Take your oil.
Oh, take your oil.
Take your oil.
What does that mean?
It's kind of like, you've made your bed, so lie in
it. Lie in it, aye.
You know, and I think it comes from taking cod liver oil or having to take your medicine.
We don't suffer fools,
No, we don't both suffer fools at all.
I'd say anybody that has a problem with Nadine's accent needs to wise up and catch themselves
on. There you go. Snowdrops and daffodils,
butterflies and bees. Gina and Erin, Niamh and Rachel, and on Friday you can hear four teenage real Derry girls. Still to come in today's programme, Super Troopers, the ABBA exhibition, a tour around the band's history, and of course there will be a tune or two. Now, most of us look forward to the day off work on Christmas Day and getting together with family and friends around a table, heaving with culinary delights, but more than a million people will be working tomorrow, more than ever before, according to the TUC, and they'll include chefs, waiters, bar staff, police, but the greatest number, some 300,000, will be nurses and care workers. What's it like to spend your Christmas Day in hospital? Well, Molly Case is a clinical nurse specialist for inherited cardiac conditions at St George's Hospital in South London and the author of How to Treat People, A Nurse at Work. And Christy Watson was a paediatric nurse for 20 years and has written The Language of Kindness, A Nurse's Story. Christy, what are your favourite memories of working at Christmas?
Well, I've got lots, actually. I think Christmas can be a very, very sad place in hospitals, but actually it's also a place where you really focus on the things that matter the most. And there was a particular year where I was looking after a baby boy who was an ex-premature baby. He was very, very sick. He had chronic lung disease and he was on maximum support, maximum life support, maximum amount of drugs. And his blood results were quite possibly incompatible with life. We really didn't have much hope that he would survive at all. And then he turned the corner on Christmas Day. Everyone kept talking about it being a Christmas miracle of sorts. And obviously we were very stressed out, working Christmas Day, really, really busy, had families at home that we'd left to come to work. But actually it was such an enormous privilege to see his family and be able to look after him. And the look on his mum's face when he turned a corner and we knew that he might survive was really what it's all about, and it made everything worthwhile.
Molly, what's your special memory?
One of my favourite memories, and one that I'll never forget, is from a little while ago. I was working as a care worker looking after people with Alzheimer's in a residential care home before I decided to become a nurse. And for some reason, I'd put money on horse racing, which is not like me at all, as a kind of 20-year vegetarian and big fan of horses. And I won nearly 200 quid on it and felt terribly guilty. So spent the money instead on a brand new CD player. This was about 10 years ago. And loads of old musical CDs for the residents in the care home. And I will never forget myself and little Elsie, who was nearly 100 years old, kind of pirouetting in the living room listening to Perry Como Christmas album. And that was on Christmas Day, and that was just a memory that is heaven.
Christy, as a nurse in paediatric intensive care, how do you manage to support parents who are under so much pressure when you're under pressure yourselves?
It's very difficult sometimes, a lot of the time, but it's all about sacrifice, I think. Sacrifice is the right word, and that's what people are doing when they're working Christmas Day. That's what they're doing when they're giving so much of themselves to be able to walk in very, very difficult shoes and to be able to be with someone at their most profound and difficult moments of their lives. And to support them in a number of ways. It might be with clinical expertise, it might be with your skill as a nurse that you've built up over a number of years, but I think the thing that matters most to parents and families is listening, kindness, and the small actions that you do that make a huge difference to them during their most darkest hours.
What difficult moments have you had at Christmas?
I think when I used to work on a high dependency unit for heart surgery, it was a very kind of fast flowing unit and people were often acutely unwell but then got better very quickly once they were fixed from their surgery. But we had a gentleman who stayed with us for a long time, and he was a Jehovah's Witness, and therefore it was his decision that he didn't want a blood transfusion prior to his surgery. So it was our job to make sure that we could try and increase his blood level in a different way so that he was safe enough to have surgery. And Christmas Eve, kind of the few nights before he was meant to have his surgery, I remember going up to the paediatric wards where I didn't work, I'm an adult nurse, to collect tiny baby bottles in order to draw his blood in the smallest quantities we could. And the paediatric wards were this incredible place with Santa's grotto and penguins and these children that looked so sick but were all laughing. And then I would come down back to this gentleman who was very poorly, take his blood in these tiny, tiny little kind of tiny baby bottles and test his blood and see if his blood level was safe enough to have his operation. And in the end, we never were able to get his blood level to a level that was safe enough to operate for fear of losing too much. And he passed away without having his heart operation. But what I always remember from that Christmas kind of period was that he died with absolute choice, absolute dignity. And we spent the kind of his last hours talking about what his faith meant to him. And even though I'm an atheist, it really taught me a lot about living and dying.
Christy, what was it like for family and friends when you had to say, sorry, I'm working on Christmas Day?
It's interesting, Molly, you're talking about faith, because I think that and whatever you believe, that nursing is a kind of faith in itself. It's a faith and a tolerance and respect for every single human being regardless. And there is something that people respect about that. So that families and friends of nurses, I think, I mean, certainly my experience, are very understanding of the fact that you are going to work, it's part of your job, it's part of something bigger about humanity. And, I mean, it's a sacrifice for them as well. But I do think that my children particularly have been used to not having mum at home sometimes on Christmas. And that must be very tough, but they also understand that Christmas is so much more than just being with the people you love sometimes, and even having things like presents. And when you work in a place like paediatric intensive care, it really shows you what's important in life. The other thing is, obviously, the NHS is completely reflective of our society, and some people don't celebrate Christmas, and that goes for staff, patients. It's a very, very diverse culture within the organisation, but it's a very special day whether people are at work or at home.
I mean, some of your colleagues will be working in, I still call it casualty, I'm afraid.
No,
I'm
that's
a bit
fine.
About that. I know I'm supposed to call it accident and emergency.
It's emergency department now. It's moved on again.
What's it like for them? Because Christmas must be such a busy time.
I think the casualty is now, it's because it's so incredibly chock-a-block, and obviously they talk about the winter crises that are coming and things like that. I think the greatest problem for staff is bed capacity and the stresses of that. It's not at all about patients coming in with, you know, various respiratory illnesses or broken hips or things like that. It's not the nature of what the patient's coming in
or
with.
Or alcohol poisoning.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. It's to do with the resources and not having a bed necessarily to pass them through to on the wards. That's the greatest stress, is being understaffed and under-resourced at Christmas time. I think that's the greatest stress for our colleagues.
I think the emergency department at this time of year, they definitely see a peak in in sometimes rather unfortunate accidents. I know one of my colleagues had a woman who put too much brandy on her Christmas pudding and then set her hair alight, for example.
Never too much brandy.
That was a bad case. Mm. But there are peaks in sort of alcohol and substance misuse. There are issues with spikes in domestic violence and hate crime. And there's a lot of suffering that goes on at Christmas as well. And I think sometimes you see that in hospitals perhaps more than anywhere else. Mm. It's a sad time for many people.
Well, Christy Watson, Molly Case, thank you both very much indeed for being with us this morning.
Thank you.
And I hope you will be with your families tomorrow.
Thank you.
Thank you both. Now, it is no secret that I have long been the number one fan of Mamma Mia, both the stage and the film version. I've seen it in the theatre 8 times, and whenever I'm a bit fed up, I watch the film on the telly. ABBA is without doubt one of the most successful bands of all time, and there's now an exhibition at the O2 Centre in London with costumes, lyrics and photos, many of which have never been shown in the UK. Jane, don't know why they didn't send me, but they sent Jane, went there with the assistant curator, Sid Moore.
Now, I obviously am a child of ABBA time, so I'm excited to be here. Take us back to the dark days of 1974, which actually is where the exhibition starts, and the Eurovision Song Contest that year was in Brighton. And what did we get? What did we see?
So, Jane, if you can imagine a country divided, political discord, election coming after election, then you have quite a dark and dreary landscape, like literally with power cuts as well, the 3-day week. And into this, on Saturday the 6th of April 1974, we see this burst of joyous celebration and colour, and these beautiful young people bursting onto the stage in the Dome.
In the Brighton Dome, that's right. Dome, I do remember I was 10 and everyone was talking about nothing else for weeks afterwards. We are looking now at the costumes they wore in Brighton on that fateful night in 1974. Now, can you describe, first of all, let's look at what the girls were wearing that night. And Frida is in kind of, it's rather a nice peasant skirt in brown colours.
Yeah, so it's brown and orange, which were obviously very 70s colours at the time as well. But if you look at the costumes, you can see that they've got chains on and they've got badges on and spangles as well and epaulettes as well, metallic epaulettes at the top. And Frida actually went to a friend of hers called Inga Svenica. She had a boutique in Stockholm, and she decided that, well, the whole band had decided they didn't want to look the same as the other contestants at Eurovision. They wanted to look different. They wanted to be memorable. Of course, they had really different colours in all of them as well.
Yeah, Agneta's costume is blue.
Is blue, and she did have quite a bit of an influence in women's makeup.
With the blue eyeshadow,
you know, which is still fashionable with some women today. Frida preferred, she was a bit more sophisticated with her palette, and she preferred Madame Rochus and Yves Saint Laurent. But Agneta liked lip gloss, and she liked pink, and she liked blue eyeshadow, but of course, you know, she was blonde, so the blue looked fantastic.
It's a gorgeous blue. It's a sort of metallic, how would you describe that blue? Metallic blue, velvet shirt, electric blue, okay.
Yeah, velvet shirt,
silk shortish trousers.
But which is tapered at the bottom as well. And, you know, look at Benny's outfit as well. So he's wearing these little cut-off pedal pushers with silver and burgundy. And again, they've got lots and lots of badges. And it's kind of like got that slight military edge to it with the epaulettes. And, of course, we remember as well when the conductor came in at the Dome, he was dressed up as Napoleon.
That's right, I do remember.
Yeah, the public loved that. They were kind of like... began to get on their side as soon as he walked in. And over here we have Bjorn's outfit as well, which is a kind of silvery grey. I think in this one you can see the military influence as well. And he had his star guitar on.
That's right.
As well, which we've got.
It's worth saying, of course, the women's outfits were at this point certainly not remotely revealing.
That's true.
They were sexy, but not revealing.
I think, you know, you've got to remember this was skin tight as well.
Yeah, okay.
So, you know, although they weren't revealing, as in showing flesh. They were sexy, they were skin tight, they were definitely showing off the curves. Definitely. And that was for the boys as well, though.
Yeah, the boys showed off their curves. Yeah, yeah. Magnificently. Look at me now. What about in gender terms? I think actually this was something that was discussed at the time. The girls, there was the blonde one, the brunette, and they didn't write the songs.
No, they didn't. But I mean, they had a lot of input into the songs. And certainly if you think about, well, I think one of the magical elements of ABBA is the way the girls harmonise with Frieda as a mezzo-soprano and Agnetta as a soprano. And they, you know, the band was extremely democratic.
We know that,
really,
do we?
Okay. Really democratic. They all took decisions together. And the girls would not sing anything they didn't want to sing. They wouldn't wear anything they didn't want to wear. They were very, very strong women. And, you know, again, to me, growing up, they seemed to represent kind of friendship and sisterhood as well. And I think even today, when you're, I don't know, whether you're at a party and ABBA comes on, the girls will look at each other before they go out. And that kind
of... that recognition,
isn't it? It's like, hey, let's get on the dance floor. You know, some of the lyrics and the way they presented them, they were very much, you know, they were mothers and they were wives and they were friends, and they had this fantastic teamwork that was going on stage. If one of them didn't feel completely up to the performance, the other one would come out.
Compensate.
And, yeah, if you think about some of their lyrics, things like "Lay all your love on me," I mean, it's quite physical. Kisses of fire, burning.
I'm at the point of no return.
Exactly.
Absolutely no returning.
They're quite sexual as well. Yeah. And I feel that they are women who speak about female dreams and desire, who are desired as well.
There is the song about parenthood slipping through my fingers, which I find that all very hard to listen to.
Slipping through my fingers all the time, I try to catch her.
There was a degree to which they celebrated the domestic and the family, wasn't there? Which I think people may have forgotten about.
Yeah, I mean, it was really important to them that they spent time with their families, which is why they developed all the videos, so that they didn't have to go on tour very much. They had summer homes on a Swedish island, where we've got some footage as well, really beautiful footage of the girls without makeup on. Everyone's very relaxed, playing guitar with the kids sort of crawling over them in their 70s outfits. And that was important to them. Also, it was really different to the way rock stars were being presented at that time. I mean, you know, certainly in this room, which is about ABBA, the album ABBA, it was released same year as artists like T-Rex, Hawkwind, Rush, Yes, Kiss were releasing albums. And, you know, I think ABBA...
The idea of watching Mark Bolan do the washing up or something like that, it wouldn't have happened, would it? Or doing his garden.
Yeah, or like spreading some pate and give it to a kid,
No, it wouldn't happen.
No, it just really wouldn't. But it was important to them that they maintained... They had kids, all of them, at this point, so they wanted to spend time with the children. And when they were interviewed, people would say, you know, so what do you do in your spare time? And they weren't throwing TVs out of hotel rooms. They say, you know, they were interested in cooking, they were interested in reading, listening to music, dancing, exercising. When they went on tour in 79, apparently, according to Carl Magnus Palm, their biographer, so after one of the gigs, someone had arranged a post-gig party with strippers. So they went down, and obviously the person who had organised that hadn't done their research properly, so ABBA went down and sort of went, very nice, and then retreated back and had parties in their own room.
Oh, the relief, because if they'd embraced the notion of a party with strippers, I think a lot of our listeners would have been quite disappointed, to be honest.
Like a super trooper, lights are gonna find me shining like the sun.
The assistant curator, Sid Moore, was talking with Jane. Now, Rachel tweeted, listening to the brilliant and witty Joanna Scanlon, struck by her reflective honesty on the difficulty of being a pioneer. The Waters Company said, Joanna Scanlon being honest and thoughtful, lovely. And then Viv Rose said, much as I agree wholeheartedly with your article on nurses, it would be so nice to hear some appreciation for those prison officers who have to work also. I'm a retired officer who worked many Christmases and New Years, and our dedication is not always recognised by those we serve. The prison service is invariably overlooked when the public services are lauded. Perhaps your programme could rectify this in a small statement. And then Irene Lockwood said, I'm just uploading the shopping on Christmas Eve morning and I've so enjoyed listening to the two nurses talking about working on Christmas Day. Their commitment, compassion and indeed sacrifice was soul enhancing. At times I feel frustrated that Women's Hour only extols the success of female judges, financiers or heads of corporate companies, but here are two women representing their profession so admirably. Of course I'm biased. I'm a retired nurse who has some wonderful, heartwarming memories of Christmas past. And then Vicky said, although I understand that there are more nurses working Christmas Day than any other industry, I feel that by focusing on nursing, you're not acknowledging the many other workers who are not recognised and don't have the same rewards from their jobs. The many in the hospital sector, cleaners, social workers on call, the staff in the local spa shop who for some reason think they have to open Christmas Day. They get no or little job satisfaction and most likely no extra money for working tomorrow. And Kerry tweeted, 10 seconds of slipping through my fingers and I'm a blubbering mess with mascara running down my cheeks. And Kerry, I know exactly what you mean. Now, do join me tomorrow, if you can, 10:02 for Christmas Day on Woman's Hour. We'll be talking about Christmas traditions, why some of us love them and some of us, frankly, don't. And we'll examine the history of the turkey, the cranberry sauce and the plum pudding. Are they really traditional to this culture or have they come from somewhere else? Then on Boxing Day, we'll be talking about winners in 2019 and I'll begin talking with the amazing Edna O'Brien. Just one other point, if you're still looking for ideas on how to achieve a more eco-friendly Christmas, there's an article on the Woman's Hour website, 9 Tips for a Greener Christmas, and there's also a video on Instagram and Twitter at BBC Woman's Hour. Now enjoy your Christmas Eve tonight and I hope I'll see you tomorrow. Bye-bye.
Hello, I'm Greg Jenner, host of You're Dead to Me, the funny history podcast for people who don't like history. And if you enjoyed Series 1, boy, do I have a special festive treat for you. Yes, me and Santa's elves have been bashing away in the workshop, and we've loaded his sleigh with a brand new episode all about, well, you can probably guess. So join me, the hilarious Russell Kane, and our clever historian Dr. Fern Riddell as we crack cracker gags and get to grips with how the Victorians did Christmas. You can find it now and all the other episodes under your tree or on BBC Sounds.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.